Hello from the World Newsroom in Boston, Massachusetts. This is the World's Technology Podcast. I'm Jason Margolis. The World is a joint production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. French jazz musician Eric Truffaz playing our introductory music. On the program this week, exploring the ocean's floors, a maestro of the video game world, and we continue looking at issues around global warming, this time a story from Bangladesh, and a big chunk of change coming in to fight climate change. We'll close the show with a story about promoting HIV awareness in Africa through music, and some emails from you. First, though, a story from the depths of the ocean. I went to downtown Boston this week to the Heinz Convention Center to the Oceans 2006 conference. I met up with Justin Manley, who is an ocean engineer with the company Battelle and is a consultant to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We talked about autonomous underwater vehicles, or AUVs. Here's our discussion.
AUVs, autonomous underwater vehicles, are smart robots. They carry batteries and computers and sensors, and they go underwater all by themselves after they've been programmed, and they execute tasks. Those tasks can be many. They can map the bottom of the ocean. They can study for pollutants. They can do a lot of good things for a lot of important user communities.
How much of the ocean's subsurface have we actually explored?
Essentially, if you look at the ocean, roughly 70% of our planet, somewhere between 5 and maybe 10% of that body has been, I would say, explored. Essentially, most of it we know very little about.
Perhaps a naive question, but what are the benefits of exploring the ocean's floor?
Sure. There are a lot of issues about not just the ocean floor, but the ocean itself, the water. The ocean generates and regulates our climate. The ocean floor is a source of an important resource for most of us right now, gasoline, petroleum we get out of the ocean floor. There's rich biodiversity, a lot of interesting organisms. New medicines have been evolved from marine compounds we find in the ocean. Whole host of societal benefits from understanding and exploring the ocean.
Okay, so we're in a room right now surrounded by these AUVs, so let's walk around and take a look. Why don't you point out a few of your favorites for me, or a few of the more interesting ones?
Sure. This autonomous underwater vehicle we see on the floor is a yellow cylindrical object. It looks a lot like a torpedo. It has a propeller on the end of it and a mast up top that carries communication antennas so that when it can surface, we can find it. If we could see inside of it, we would see pressure vessels that hold batteries and computers and protect it from the ocean depths. But all you see on the outside is there to make it smooth so that it swims through the water more efficiently.
And what kind of information would that yellow torpedo-looking device bring back? Pictures, or would it bring back actual samples, or would it measure salinity, temperature?
Autonomous vehicles tend not to bring back samples in that it's kind of hard to teach a robot to stop and pick something up, and then it's even harder to pick up the right thing. But they do use all kinds of equipment, sonars, cameras, oceanographic sensors that measure how hot the water is, how much salt is in the water. These are all properties that an AUV can measure.
You were going to show me some others.
Sure. This one is just interesting. This is an R&D effort out of Australia. They call themselves Project Sea Swarm. As you can see, this is a very small platform. And their idea is instead of one or two very big vehicles, like that one we saw over there, they have these little ones, and they're going to put them out in groups. And this group will work together in a small area, you know, tens of square meters, but they'll work together to cover the ground. It's a neat, different approach, and they're hoping that way they'll be a little cheaper, perhaps, and a little more robust. If one of them breaks, the rest of them will still get the job done. Whereas if one of the big ones breaks and you've only got one, well, now you got a problem.
So would you estimate this is about a foot and a half, or for international listeners, about 80 centimeters maybe?
80 centimeters might be a bit much. I might say 50. But this is a small vehicle. This is easily something you can hold in the palm of your hand. So that's a big contrast to that other vehicle that's a couple of meters long and probably weighs several hundred pounds.
Do we have any limitations right now for how deep in the ocean we can go, and can these AUVs bring us farther along in the depths of the ocean?
The explicit answer is that the limit is really one of cost. We can reach the bottom of the ocean. The deepest point in the ocean is not quite 11,000 meters deep. We don't make AUVs that go that deep routinely because it's just very, very expensive. But the deeper we go, the more cost-effective an AUV becomes, because in contrast to some of the other things you see around you, which use cables to connect to the surface, if you have a cable, and then you've got a very long cable, it takes up space on deck, it makes your ship bigger and more complicated. So AUVs are actually a more cost-effective way of getting deep.
Are there any particular regions of the world that we need to explore that are more important than the others, or are they all equally important?
Well, I think the generic answer would be any information is better than no information, and we face a lot of cases of no information. There are some exciting regions that are a little more compelling. Geothermal activity, vents where there's hot gases from the center of the Earth spewing into the ocean. Coral reefs are exciting, full of biodiversity. Another interesting subject is methane hydrates, a potential new energy source. So there's all kinds of different sites that are interesting, but we only find those sites by exploring the whole ocean. So we got to cover ground to find the ideal places we want to go look at more.
In your talk, you brought up the question, is the technology mature and is it real? Is it mature?
There are facets of the technology that are mature. We could go to a booth, we could talk to one of these companies, and we could place an order and buy a piece of equipment that would do certain jobs pretty well. Some of these vendors deliver to the U.S. Navy. This type of technology has been used in Iraq, and it has been used in military exercises and demonstrated its effectiveness.
How was it used in Iraq?
In Iraq, there was a situation where a port, they wanted to bring supplies into a port, and they needed to make sure that there were no mines that were going to sink our supply ships. And they used these robots to go in and map the harbor. This is not new. They've always done this kind of activity, but this was the first time they did it with the robots. They used to use divers or other techniques.
What other governments besides the United States are in the market for buying devices like these?
There's actually, because these have reduced the cost of access to the ocean, there's a lot more interest in this technology than some other much more expensive systems. For example, submarines that carry people, research submersibles, are very rare. All of the countries that have those kind of technologies pursue these. The French have autonomous vehicles. The Russians have interesting programs. Japan has many vehicles and providers. And then you have the United Kingdom, for example, which doesn't have a traditional manned submersible oceanography community the way we think of it, but they have these kind of robotic systems.
What about the future? What's next? I mean, are we looking at the future right now in this very hallway?
You are definitely looking at the short-term future here in the exhibition hall, because this is where the products available are being marketed. New technologies are always evolving. This technology is always evolving. And it may be a poor analogy, but much like your PC or your cell phone has gotten better with almost each passing year, this technology moves pretty quickly.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade. He'd let us in, knows where we've been, in his octopus's garden in the shade. I'd ask my friends to come and see an octopus's garden with me.
A little Ringo Starr singing on Abbey Road, the finest of all the Beatles albums without a doubt. Maybe the White Album could rival it. It's a matter of personal taste. That's neither here nor there, though. It's time to talk about climate change. In Bangladesh, the BBC's environment analyst Roger Harabin went to Bangladesh to find out if people can adapt to climate change there.
It's dawn in Bangladesh. We're on the mighty Brahmaputra River, which splits and curves as it carves its way through this low-lying land. And we're going to see some of the most vulnerable people in the world to climate change. We've been travelling for about an hour, getting an impression of the scale of this vast river. So wide you can barely see from one bank to the other. We've been watching fishermen cast their nets and birds flitting over the water. And we've landed on an island known as a Chor. Now this is a temporary island produced by siltation. The Chors only last on average about 20 years before they're swept away again. But Bangladesh is so densely populated and so short of land that these islands are quickly taken over by people.
Families here are already environmental refugees. Take Jarina Katten. She's a young mother of two, and already she's been flooded twice out of her home.
Okay, again, they were living in a family there, and she had seven brothers and sisters. It was a big family. Her father was a day laborer, but also doing some work in weaving factory. And they were living in the Charanpur Chor, and they had to leave the Chor because there was Chor erosion with the flood water.
Okay.
So they also lost their homes, their cattle, their goats, their chicken, everything that they lost.
At the centre of the Chor, where the land's at its highest, a couple of dozen men and women are digging into the sandy soil, flipping it into baskets, and then carrying it up to a platform which is just emerging. It's being thumped down solid by a man with a large lump of wood. This is a project that will shield them from the worst of their vulnerability when the floods inevitably come. And it's funded by the British Government Department DFID. Their representative Michael Scott is with me. Michael, this seems like the sort of thing that villagers ought to be doing themselves. Why are you paying them to do it?
These people are daily labourers who earn just enough money each day to feed themselves. They have no reserve cash, no reserve income. It will take a family 80 days to raise a house like this, and 80 days without income would mean starvation for many of them.
Jarina Katten's one of the lucky ones here who've managed to get the help to raise the platform for their house. She's also been given livestock by the British Aid Programme. It focuses on movable assets like livestock because they're more floodproof.
She's very happy with the cattle and the plains. Two cattle were given to her family. One cattle died. She has one cattle now. It's now grown up and they're very comfortable with that.
But Jarina will have to move again. There's no long-term future here. Experts say life in this disaster-prone land will be made even more precarious because of climate change. Salim Ulhuk from the International Institute for Environment and Development travelled with us.
The long-term prognosis for these people is unfortunately almost impossible to survive on these chores. They might survive for a few more years, maybe a decade or two, but in the longer term, they're not going to be able to survive on these islands anymore.
What's the long-term impact going to be of climate change on Bangladesh as a whole?
The whole of Bangladesh is going to be hit by a number of impacts of climate change, ranging from sea level rise to hurricanes or cyclones, as they're known here, and rising river levels as well, particularly the major rivers like the Brahmaputra and the Ganges, and increasingly drought as well, particularly in the northwestern region of the country.
So what can you do to help these people?
Well, in the medium to short term, we're going to have to help them cope with these impacts of climate change, which are now inevitable. In the longer term, we're going to have to help them move out of the most vulnerable areas, perhaps into towns or in less vulnerable areas of agriculture production.
Do you think that the world is geared up to the scale of this challenge? And we're talking about tens of millions of people here on the move just in Bangladesh.
Well, unfortunately, the world isn't geared for current problems, let alone future climate change problems, but we have to do our best to make sure that the world does get geared for this.
The British government will shortly receive a report from an eminent economist, Professor Sir Nicholas Stern, on the economic impacts of climate change. He'll say rich nations have to cut emissions of greenhouse gases urgently to stop climate change spinning way out of control.
But he'll also warn that rich nations must do far more to help countries like Bangladesh cope with climate problems that they did not cause.
I want to add anything that I can add.
That's the music of the world's very own Alex Galifant. And that, of course, well, for the last 2 weeks, it means it's time for emails from you. I think maybe I'll make this the theme music for listener emails. First, a note from London from Andrew Spark. Andrew had some issues with our story last week about the 25th anniversary of the PC. Andrew writes, "Okay, I realize that you were reporting on the 25th anniversary of the IBM PC, but to describe that as the 25th anniversary of the personal computer is not entirely fair. You really should have at least mentioned the Apple II. IBM was only responding to the creation of a market for personal computers, which occurred with the Apple II. To claim that this particular date is the 25th anniversary of the PC is to give the misleading impression that IBM invented the PC. I look forward to hearing you address the balance at a future date." Okay, I didn't actually report that story, so I'm relatively innocent, but I did hear from some of my colleagues in London who did put that piece together, and they received similar feedback from their listeners in the United Kingdom. My peers at the BBC said the focus of their story last week was on IBM. They agree with the points made about Macintosh, but they say the story wasn't meant to be an all-inclusive story, just a quick report on the 25th anniversary of IBM's PC. But Andrew, your point is still well taken, and thank you for writing. Next, a quick bonjour to Laval, France, and Susan Loubet's English class at the Azia West Engineering School. Professor Loubet tells me that she's incorporating our podcast into her course. Merci beaucoup. Thanks for your letter and thanks for listening. And a note from listener Steve Gelmes, who splits time between Sweden and Virginia. Steve writes, "So far my impression is that most of your environmental stories are about the problems we are facing. Habitat destruction, methane release from melting permafrost, migration of invasive species, etc. I commend that reporting, and would not like anything I say here to result in that being diluted to any degree. But I think people need to be introduced to ways to respond to the climate change crisis as much as they need to understand what it is and means. Otherwise, too many people will either tune out or become despondent and resigned." Steve also sent me a long email with a wealth of great story ideas about alternative energies in Europe, Japan, and Canada. And I thank him for that. I'm currently trying to pursue a few of those ideas from Steve right now, including a story about wind energy up in Canada. So I'll probably be heading up to Ontario in the next few weeks, thanks to Steve's heads up. And on Steve's point that we need to look at what we can do to fight climate change, what technology really needs more than anything is, drumroll please, money. And it looks like those who are concerned about climate change just got a big boost this week. Here's the world's host, Marco Werman, with more on that.
British billionaire Richard Branson says he wants to put some of his money where his mouth is. Branson is the chairman of the Virgin Group, which owns the Virgin Atlantic airline. He's also an advocate for more research on global warming. And today Branson pledged $3 billion to that cause. The money, he said, will come from the profits generated by Virgin Atlantic and other companies over the next 10 years. Branson made the announcement in New York as part of the global initiative run by former President Bill Clinton. Branson said his pledge will be used to research and develop alternatives to fossil fuels.
Global warming will only be tackled if you can invest in initiatives which hopefully will make a return. Some may not, some will.
Richard Branson's announcement is the latest piece of global philanthropy from a business billionaire. Daniel Gross writes the Money Box column for Slate magazine. What exactly is Richard Branson saying he'll do with the proceeds from his transport business? I mean, he's talking about making a return on his investment, which doesn't sound that philanthropic.
Absolutely. If you look at what he's talking about, committing the profits from his transportation companies, i.e. companies that create a lot of emissions, like airplanes, and companies that pay a ton of money for fuel. So you can see there's probably a certain level of self-interest here. He's saying that he's going to dedicate profits to help create new technologies and processes that will, you know, allow his planes and trains to emit fewer emissions and also potentially to get access to alternative energy sources.
Are people sort of accepting the notion that in order for solutions to be effective, they might have to also be profit-making at the same time?
I think over the last probably two decades, there's been a growing acceptance and embrace of the notion that the profit motive can be a very important factor in helping to attack and cure some of the world's most difficult problems, everything from, you know, clean water in Africa to global warming.
Well, Dan, contrast that with sort of the templates of philanthropy, sort of, you know, the Fords, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers. Right. How did those models work?
It goes back to a very strong religious sense that it wasn't their money, it was money to be shared. In Rockefeller's case, it was also part of a sort of effort to either redeem his reputation or get out from under a reputation that he was a monopolist. So he took all his profits from his company and put them in a foundation that gave a small part of its assets away each year so it could do so in perpetuity. Bill Gates has really followed a similar model, created a separate foundation that had nothing to do with Microsoft, nothing to do with software, to give away money to try to combat ills. But underneath this, you see a countervailing trend going on a smaller scale of companies trying to align their products and services with philanthropic efforts.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which you mentioned, is well known for being one of the largest philanthropic organizations in the world. There are also the huge gifts made by Ted Turner and Warren Buffett, and Richard Branson's announcement today comes hard on the heels of a plan to tackle a range of global problems from the founders of Google. So are they networked in some way to avoid redundancy, or are they each an insular operation?
The important effect is not so much the sort of formal links, but rather the informal links, the sense that Buffett and Gates kind of set the example, and Turner as well. They create the expectation that when you become a billionaire, there's immediately this expectation that you will do something positive with your wealth and that you will do it sooner rather than later.
Dan Gross writes the Money Box column for Slate. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
The World Cyber Games Grand Finals are coming up next month in Italy. Dave Geffon will be there. He's a member of Team 3D. They're kind of like the New York Yankees of computer gaming. And by that comparison, I mean they always win. Dave will be among the world's elite 700 gamers from 70 countries in Italy. I caught up with Dave this week on his cell phone in Austin, Texas for a brief interview. The cell phone coverage wasn't the best, but you can hear him just fine. Now, also, full disclosure, I'm not a gamer, so pardon me if my questions seem a little naive. For the uninitiated, Dave shared a little bit about the world of gaming and what makes him so good.
I've actually been gaming since the mid-80s. I'm 24 years old, and I mean, literally as young as I can remember playing on my dad's Atari. I really took an interest in PC gaming and the actual side of competitive gaming in the late 90s and like early 2000, where I started playing PC games competitively.
And tell me, what did you win last weekend in Las Vegas? What game did you win in?
I won in a game called Half-Life Counter-Strike, which is a 5v5 team-based game. It's objective-based, and for each, I think it's 1 minute and 45 second round, You have an objective to either play offense or defense in the first team to 16 wins.
And I'm sorry, are you shooting other people? Or?
Yes, I'm playing a first-person shooter. You use guns ranging from anywhere from pistols to submachine guns to assault rifles to heavy machine guns and anything in between.
And you won this last year as well?
Actually, we've won in the United States 5 years in a row. We're representing the United States for the fifth time this year in Monza, Italy. And we're actually the two-time grand final defending champions. We're going for a third title this year.
Wow. So what makes your team or what makes you so much better than the others? Is it practice or is it natural skill?
You know, it's a good question. I think I definitely think I have a lot of talent. I mean, don't get me wrong. But I think what I do have going for me is the experience. I look at gaming is very similar to poker in many respects that there's many players that can come along and, you know, have the skill to play, but experience in gaming goes a long way. I mean, there's a lot of players that might be able to compete with, you know, the top players. I mean, there's lots of players out there that could probably kill me, you know, in a fight in game. But the thing that separates the top players such as myself is our immense amount of experience that we have over anybody else. I mean, you can throw me into any given situation, and I don't have to think twice about it because I know exactly what to do. And that's what goes a long way, and that's really what separates the best from, you know, just good players.
How often do you practice?
We have a pretty stringent practice schedule. We practice Sunday through Thursday for about 5 hours a day, and then usually players play on their own time about 3 hours a day. So we're playing anywhere between 8 and 10 hours a day usually.
Now, does that leave time for a job, or is this your job?
This is our job. This is my job.
I know it's a rude question in our society, but I'm a journalist, and I'm supposed to ask rude questions. Can I ask how much money you earned in your best years as a gamer?
I think this year will probably be one of my better years, and I think I'm going to be, I think I'm projecting to make somewhere around $50,000 to $60,000.
And any endorsement deals, or where do you get this money from? Is it from winning tournaments?
I get my money from my team. Team 3D is fully sponsored by Intel and NVIDIA. They provide us with salary so we can concentrate on playing games full time. I get money from winning tournaments. I'm actually currently writing a how-to guide. You can make money doing lots of different things. There's players who have their own line of mouse pads. There's some players that give lessons, like almost like a tennis pro. So there's definitely many different ways we can earn money playing games.
Are you excited for Italy this year?
I'm very excited. The probability of actually winning 3 grand finals championship titles in a row. I mean, you know, winning one's always special. Some players never even get that feeling, but to win it 3 times in a row would be something really amazing.
Kidnapped by Turkish pirates, Mediterranean thug. After some torture, they considered me their mascot, a Cypriotic good luck. I had the taste of death and many other things. I had the
And last, a story about HIV/AIDS. I received some letters from listeners saying you'd like to hear more stories about antiretroviral treatments for AIDS. Our health desk is always working on stories about this, looking for stories from across the globe. But did you know that globally, it's estimated that 90% of people infected with HIV don't even know that they carry the virus? That's long been a frustration of public health officials. Here's the story of an aid worker in Africa who had an idea for how to encourage HIV testing. He became an unlikely pop star in the process. Former editor with The World, Suzanne Marmion, filed this story from the southern African nation of Malawi.
Kohei Yamada comes from a wealthy country, Japan, a nation of neon lights and bullet trains, where a melon can cost $100. He wanted to help the world's poor. So 3 years ago, Yamada signed up to do aid work in Malawi, one of the least developed countries in Africa. He was assigned to a village with mud huts to live in, and no electricity or running water. After a while, he noticed that many of the people he was working with were dying from AIDS. One of his best friends told him he was infected, and so were members of his family.
Wife also infected, and his baby also dead, and I attended a lot of funerals. This tragedy actually happened all around me, and I was always thinking about what I could do.
More than 14% of adults in Malawi are HIV positive. Yet many people are afraid to take an HIV test. One big reason is that people fear a positive test will bring rejection from family and friends. So Kohei Yamada decided to write a song that he hoped would reduce the stigma of HIV.
This is a love song about HIV/AIDS.
Yamada's song tells the story of a young man who goes to get tested with his girlfriend. Unfortunately, the boyfriend's test comes back positive. He expects his girlfriend to leave him. He tells her she's beautiful, she'll find another, better man. But she answers, "Don't talk like that," and promises, "We'll be together forever."
The title of the song is Dimakukonda, which meaning I love you in English.
Yamada sings in Malawi's main language, Chichewa. He doesn't speak Chichewa, but that didn't stop him. Nor did the fact that he'd never written music or performed a song before. A Malawian musician friend helped him with all this, and insisted that Yamada sing the words since he wrote them. The friend said a foreigner singing a Malawi's local language would make people take notice. People certainly did, especially because of the music video Yamada created. It shows the couple meeting and falling in love, and going through the HIV testing process step by step. Throughout the video, Yamada pops up in a kimono, playing the part of a Japanese warrior.
My concept is that a samurai fighting against HIV/AIDS.
Many Malawians didn't get it. They didn't realize that Yamada was supposed to be a samurai. They thought he was a martial arts expert, like movie stars Bruce Lee and Jackie Chan.
They always ask me, "Are you the kung fu master or a karate fighter? Are you a black belt or something like that?" And I always say, I'm the black belt and I'm a kung fu master. And they really respect me, you know.
People in Malawi loved the song. It became an instant hit. It was even nominated for Malawi's version of a Grammy. The video plays constantly on Malawi's sole TV station. Television Malawi journalist Chaliwa Katola says viewers request the video more than any other. And he's glad because it contains an important message.
AIDS is a killer, and we need to be careful. The idea that maybe lovers, first, before they get married, they have to go and have a test is a very brilliant idea.
Malawi's Japanese pop star Kohei Yamada has written another song in Chichewa called Temenye Nkondo. It means, "Now is the time to fight," and it compares the desperate aid situation of Malawi to a war. Still, the song is packaged in the easygoing sounds most favored in the country known as the Warm Heart of Africa. Yamada recently released his AIDS songs in Japan. He says Japanese people don't talk about HIV enough in their own communities. It's not clear yet if his fellow countrymen will embrace his songs as warmly as Malawians did. But Yamada says whatever profits he makes in Japan will be funneled back to Africa to build an HIV testing center in Malawi. For the world, I'm Suzanne Marmion in Lilongwe, Malawi. Oh, oh.
That's our program for this week. Next week, I'll be taking the podcast on the road to New York City to the Wired Next Fest. If you're going to be there, if you have a booth or exhibit, drop me an email. Maybe we can meet up. jason.margolis@bbc.co.uk. Thanks very much for listening, and have a wonderful week. Tempo canto.